Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a New York Film Festival episode. I don't think I've done one yet that's just on the festival, but I've talked about a number of the movies that are in it. Very glad to be talking about the festival with Amy. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, it's a very big festival.
Where do you want to begin, or do you have anything you want to say just kind of overall about this year's edition? Or?
It's interesting. It's not so much different. I mean, I've been going to the New York Film Festival since it began in, 62 or 63. And it began really as a Eurocentric festival because it basically showed the subtitled art films that you couldn't see very easily in the United States. And at that point, we did not have any grasp of how broad cinema production was, that it, at that point, existed in almost every country in the world. And so gradually, this festival, which began as Eurocentric, particularly in the last 10 years, has become a more worldwide festival. And that's interesting.
Hmm.
I mean, sometimes this year, I think that, well, this or that film was chosen because they had to have one from that country.
Maybe we could talk about a couple of favorites that you've had that you think are the strongest of the batch you've seen so far. And if I'm not mistaken, I think one of those is Green Border.
Yeah. I mean, hands down, Green Border is, I think, the greatest film I've seen. And not because, you know, there's such different standards for how do you judge a great film? I still think that Agnieszka Holland, who directed Green Border, that her great film is Spore, and that that is the great film of this century. But this film is probably a more important film and a more necessary film, and a film that really makes other films look fussy or unnecessary or trivial, because it is about what was in 2021 and continuing going on at the border, not the border that we all see, Polish border, where they're very nice and taking in refugees from Ukraine, but the other border, the border with Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that motivated this was that in 2021, the government of Belarus invited refugees who were living in Syria and had come basically to Syria from Afghanistan and from Congo, from many countries, and were living in migrant camps. We'll give you a nice trip to Belarus in an airplane if you could just raise the money to do that, and we'll drop you in buses right at the Polish border, and you'll be able to walk across into Poland, and you'll be in the European Union, and you'll be free. That's what they actually did. And people came in droves. So Agnieszka Holland, who is Polish and also has French citizenship since from time to time, and again now she's been pretty much persona non grata in Poland, was living in Poland and found out that this situation was going on at the Belarus border, where basically these migrants were being allowed across for like 2 seconds and tossed back through the barbed wire and treated like human volleyballs. And the ones that got a little bit further were left to die in this kind of no man's land swamp. It was a grotesquely brutal situation that was instigated by Belarus, but Poland responded in kind. And it was a situation that for Holland, who is a child, even though she was born after, of the Holocaust, and her father was Jewish and her mother worked in the Polish underground. And so she grew up with that, and she's made 4 films about the Holocaust set in Poland and Austria, various places that were under Nazi rule. This seemed to her to be a parallel situation, that it was suddenly clear that the problem of mass migration is about race, and that Poland was perfectly happy to take all the Ukrainians in because they were white people and most of them white Christian people.
Mm-hmm.
but these people with different color skin coming across the other border, they wanted no part of. And they went on a total campaign to declare that they were not human. It kind of prefigured the really right-wing government that is in Poland now, this migrant crisis. So she decided to make, that the only thing she could do was to make a film, not a documentary film. And they shot it in 24 days. It took them a year to raise the money, so they didn't shoot till the beginning of 2023. And then it was in Venice this year, now in New York. And it's absolutely brilliant because she's a great, great filmmaker and she's a great technician. And she has, you know, a very wide casting base, so that it was very important to her that the Syrian family was played by Syrian actors, some of whom had been migrants to France, and that the African people were played by people from Congo, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was a group of Polish actors who had different kinds of roles. And the film is really in five parts. And it begins with the most brutal part, which is the arrival of these migrants expecting that they are going to just walk into Poland and everything's going to be copacetic, and who are then treated like, I mean, you know, this is ethnic cleansing that it was going on at that border. And that section is the most brutal, and people die and people do get tossed across like volleyballs. And after that, she focuses on one of the border guards there who believes that he is, you know, serving his country, and he has to serve his country till he begins to realize differently. And all through these sections, you re-meet and sometimes meet new migrants who are in terrible plights. That part doesn't stop, but the focus becomes people actually in Poland and what the fuck are they doing about this.
Right.
And so you have this border guard, and then you have a section that is about a group, an aid organization that follows the government rules so they can bring the stranded migrants food and water, but they're not allowed to transport them anywhere or hide them. So most of them die. And then there is a psychologist who is working in a nearby village, although she's actually from Warsaw, and she gets involved with this aid organization and realizes that they are totally ineffective, and so breaks away with two of the more radical members of the group and actually manages to do something to get three people to safety. So it's a kind of how-to primer by a director who has been involved really in activism a lot of her life. And the end is quite stunning because, I mean, I'm not giving anything away. After seeing all this, you have a different point of view when you have an epilogue that's on the Polish-Ukrainian border.
Right.
Just a stunning movie. It's stunningly made. She worked with a cinematographer. You know, it wasn't in the forest where this actually happens, but it was in a deep forest in terrain that was fairly unpredictable. And so you had the actors there. You were working fast. She was working fast. She didn't want to do reshoots. And so she basically had a cinematographer who could work documentary style and just find these actors spot on when he needed to find them, you know, and get them in the center and in focus and everything else. It's an amazing work. Amazing.
Yeah, you mentioned, like, as a technician, I mean, the filmmaking choices here are really incredibly potent. I mean, the camera work is mobile without feeling just kind of pointlessly hectic. And I guess also it's shot in a black and white, but not like a picturesque kind of black and white that maybe we've seen a little. And it's also just the narrative. I was also impressed being able to move through these different chapters and move among the character from one character to the next and shifting emphasis, which, you know, is something that she almost makes look easy, but is something that, I don't know, people have I guess, sort of stopped attempting in a way because it was so mocked. But she's not doing it to, like, I don't know, as some like kumbaya kind of panorama either. I mean, it's not like things proceed inexorably toward some improvement in the conditions. It's still a struggle. But I liked what, didn't you write in your art form report about how it's a movie that kind of shows solidarity, or almost like shows you how it's possible?
Yes. I mean, all her films, except maybe for one of the very earliest, A Woman Alone, which ends pretty hopelessly, all her films show the possibility. I mean, it's a kind of discipline. It's not sentimentality. It's, there is the possibility of doing something about this. We are not without the hope of doing something about this. And she truly believes that that is one of the reasons to make movies, to show the conditions that are, and that it is possible to change them. It's the old Gramsci thing. Mm. Pessimism of the mind, optimism of the will.
No, I mean, and it, I mean, the analyst or the psychologist, is she the last chapter, or is he like a second? She's the last chapter, right? The final.
She's in the two last chapters. Yeah. Yeah. And she manages to make allies.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different levels of allies. One of them being the border guard who comes back and does an act that shows that he's changed. And that's really in her section.
Which I mean, I kind of appreciate it because, I mean, there has to be some, it requires a leap of faith that people will change, because the alternative is you just accept that people won't.
Yeah.
Which I don't know is a way to go either. I mean, when I saw it, you go through the beginning of it, she's so good at showing the desperation of being in those woods and just profoundly bereft. I want to see it again, somehow prepared a little.
Yeah. And there are kids, and there are very little kids and pregnant women.
Yes.
And the kids cry a great deal. I asked her if the crying was post-synced, and she said, actually not. That two of the kids were the children of someone who she works with regularly on the crew, one of her ADs. And these kids, for some reason, anytime the camera would start, they would just cry.
I won't even go into one of the hardest things involves the kids, one of the kids later on. And that was picked up.
It is. I mean, I talked to her about 3 days ago, and she said they were in negotiations with a bunch of distributors, that the big distributors really don't want any part of this.
That's crazy.
But that they were very sure that they would have someone. Obviously, it did not get the nod from the Polish arts film people to be the Academy Award nominee for Poland. But I think people could really take the reviews and run with this and, you know, have a substantially successful film.
Yeah.
I was at the evening screening, the first one, and it was full. And people, every time she said anything, people would just stand up and cheer, both in her introduction and in the post-screening discussion. I mean, people were just absolutely so supportive of this film. Yeah. So I think that there is an audience for it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's good to hear. So Green Border, I mean, hopefully coming out, I guess that would probably be next year, but.
No, I don't know about that. She wants it out now.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, it was the urgency of making it,
yeah,
you know, and getting it to Venice in 6 months. And she doesn't want this to stop. It's already out in Europe, but she really does not want this to stop to wait to 24. So.
Yeah, I guess it came out in Poland like a couple of weeks ago now, if I remember.
Yes, and had the biggest opening weekend this year of any film in Poland, but was extremely controversial. And she was there with 24 hours of security.
Wow.
Because she had many death threats. And there was a lot of security around the screening. It was the one screening I went to where there were dogs and they did a bomb search before.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Which minister was it? Like
it was several ministers.
Several. Okay. It was several. Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. It was several. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the president as well called her a Nazi.
Oh, God. Okay. She just fought right back. And I think had like legal grounds for some of what they were saying. Yeah, that makes sense. It's urgent to get it out there. So that is Green Border. And then moving on to another movie, couldn't be more different. And this one was picked up immediately. That is Hitman, a Richard Linklater film, his latest feature. And this one, you also like this one.
I love Hitman, yeah. I was unaware that it has distribution. Is it Netflix or what?
Yeah, this is a Netflix acquisition that was for some large amount. Glenn Powell plays a philosophy lecturer, and somehow he falls into helping investigations, police stings of people who are trying to hire contract killers for whatever, you know, personal dispute they have. So he's helping out that kind of like on a technical or advising end. And then one day he happens to be thrown in the deep end and they say, well, you just do, you pose as the person offering hitman services and we'll just see how it goes. He takes to it somehow and then gets really into like the role playing of it and having this almost like alternate identity. So yeah, he gets involved with the woman that he had contact with through one of these stings. So he's in a kind of iffy situation there. She's played by Adria Arjona. But then the guy that he happened to replace when he first started out playing the hitman in these scenarios starts trying to cause trouble. And there's the problem of his being exposed both kind of professionally and personally with Adria Arjona's character. And it just sort of plays that all out, but not like, I didn't feel like the source of the suspense was really like, I mean, it's not like Training Day or something. It's not like it's not like a criminal. It's more of like a almost farcical situation that he's trying to stay on top of.
It is a farcical situation, but the ending is not farcical. What he says in the classroom is so stunning.
Yes.
I mean, the way I saw it was, it kind of begins like Slacker, because this guy is just kind of going through his day and there's voiceover and he encounters different people and some of them are at school and then some of them are at this police corps. And then once he starts doing this, taking on this identity as a hitman and interacting with it, just turns into a comedic version of David Cronenberg's A History of Violence.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's about identity in exactly the same way. And it has exactly the same jokes when people discover that he's not the person who he claimed to be. And how did he claim to be this person? I just thought, oh my God, I'm running A History of Violence with one side of my brain and I'm learning this film with the other. But this is comedic. And it's comedic about identity because he is capable of doing things like fucking better when he becomes the hitman than before. And he likes it.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I just watched this horror movie, Body Parts. Guy who gets his arm gets torn off and he gets a serial killer's arm transplanted, but he doesn't know it, but he then understands it because he starts acting more violent. Anyway, that's the materialist version of of this. But that's so funny. I didn't think of that comparison to History of Violence. It's almost like this is what would have happened if it was like earlier in his life, because there's not like a family at the center of it. And it really is funny. I mean, I have to say it's some of the funniest, you know, material I've seen in like a Linklater movie in a kind of a while. And I thought they had a really good rapport, Glenn Powell and Adria Arjona.
They are just amazing together.
Yeah. And also like, I mean, on both levels, like a comedic level, but also like a passion level, I think they have good chemistry too.
And then they have the third level of, and what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested to hear what you thought of like those segments where he is teaching, because he keeps teaching like throughout the movie. They'll have these kind of cutaways to where he's talking about a particular philosopher or something like that. So that kind of gets kept up. And that felt like a really, I mean, it felt like legitimate. Like when Linklater does something like that, I feel like the philosophy more than if someone's just having this lecture that's like talking about criminology or something. So I like those sequences.
I like the classroom sequences a lot. And of course, he gets a lot better and a lot more convincing when he becomes able to say, well, If you see yourself this way and you want to be this way, well, pursue it.
Yeah, it kind of inadvertently becomes self-help through becoming a fake hitman. And that reminds me that there are some people who are like a little uneasy about the fact that, well, I can't really talk about this without like talking about the ending, but some people wanted the movie to feel more accountable somehow. Yeah, you can't talk about it without stuff at the end, I guess.
You can't, but I was so happy it was not more accountable.
Uh-huh.
That it really went in the direction it did.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, I would be really interested in reading a good interview with him. I haven't done it, but because of two things. I remember years ago him saying that he was working on this story because it's based on a real story, but it was going to be, or the real story was much, much darker than what this movie is. And the guy on whom the story is based is no longer alive. So I was wondering if he had to wait till he died to be able to do this, to be able to tell his story, even though, and to be able to tell his story with one thing that is quite different.
Right. And that makes me now think, he did a story about a guy who kept making things up. Bernie.
Yeah.
That sort of comes to mind as well. Yeah. That's almost like a, not a mockumentary style, but it was kind of like a testimonial style, was pushing that along. Kind of interesting in theory, but not one of my favorites of his.
I mean, this is really a screwball.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very hard to make a screwball comedy, but this is really a screwball.
It's true. It's almost like a genuine lost art. I think because partly when people do screwballs, they try to attach it to like an action movie in some way. It's like people can't separate screwball antics from like actual like action movie just mayhem or chaos. And that's mm-hmm. kind of how people interpret it. But a lot of the screwball fun in this one just comes from, you know, the kind of poker game, poker face encounters, you know, between people. I keep talking about this, so I don't know. But when he has to go over to her house at one point and has to keep up a certain ruse, I mean, that scene, people just applauded after that scene.
I mean, the other thing is, in this festival, a really great comedy, and this is a great comedy, is rare. So you have bad comedies and kind of bad satires, but an all-out great comedy, it's such a particular kind of joy.
Definitely. To have Green Border and Hitman in the same festival, that's good.
Exactly.
That's a good exactly. thing. And then there's another movie that I'm really curious to hear what you thought of it. I mean, it's a movie that I need to see again. I wasn't able to see it in the press screening. It's a movie kind of that feels like it's changing before your eyes. At least that's how it felt for me. And that's Close Your Eyes, Victor Erice. What did you think of that one? I don't know if I should ask you to like...
I can't.
Yeah, I don't know how.
You know, I saw many years ago his first film, Spirit of the Beehive, and it is a great film. This is his fifth film, and I think his third fiction film, although, you know, they really are based on history. And this is a film about movies, old age, and lost memory, and whether representing a life in movies or in writing, if that has a value, or could you just go out there and live your life as if your life were the work of art? And this film really comes down on the side of art and representation. It begins with a scene that's set somewhere near the Spanish border in France, and you think you were watching the movie, but it turns out to be a movie within a movie, an unfinished movie, which is really weird, and really lit in very, very old-fashioned, dark Spanish movie style, like you think you're in some kind of never-ending movie where the windows are covered with tapestry curtains and you can just smell the dank air, and it's kind of Buñuel-esque. And it seems to be about a guy who's dying, who summons a guy who was in the French resistance and saved him, because the guy who's dying is Jewish, to find this guy's lost Chinese daughter. And then they play chess and there's a piano, and it really seems like one of those kind of films. And then the guy gets his mission and he walks out of the house and you hear this voiceover saying that this was a scene from a movie that was never finished, because very soon this actor who plays the resistance worker who's going off to China to find the daughter who's been lost simply disappeared off the movie set.
Hmm.
And so the next two-thirds of the movie are kind of this vague quest of the director of this movie that was never finished because he lost his actor, his vague quest to find that guy after he is on some true crime Spanish network show about this missing actor. This actor, you know, who doesn't seem like really the kind of actor that anyone would care if he went missing. I mean, a kind of impassive character actor. They do this show about it, and various pieces come to light so that the director himself goes on this half-hearted quest to try to find the missing actor. But it is kind of just peripatetic. I mean, he's just kind of wandering around, and he seems to live in the shack on the coast, and he's kind of works with a local fisherman. But he also has a locker where he stored stuff, including Lumiere Brothers' flip book and all kinds of movie, when movie was celluloid paraphernalia. So it's about lost Spanish history and the history of Franco and fascism, but it's about the loss of celluloid, really. And those kind of movies, which seems to be maybe a clue about why Arici just stopped making movies.
Hmm.
And at one point, his editor says, well, if you're looking for transcendence, there hasn't been transcendence since Dreyer. but the last 30 minutes of this movie are truly transcendent, or maybe 25 minutes. I mean, I noticed this very strange shot. Finally, he gets a clue, and he finds someone who could be and probably is the missing actor living in an old age home run by the Catholic Church. So there are very, very sweet nuns there, many very nice nuns, kind, compassionate nuns in this old age home. And there is a guy there who's totally lost his memory and looks remarkably like this actor, but remembers nothing at all. And so the director tries to figure out if this really is him. And when he decides he is, he shows a scene from the movie that we've seen at the beginning, but it's not the same scene. He assembles the guy who's probably the missing actor, two of the nuns and a social worker, and the daughter, who played the little girl in The Spirit of the Beehive and is now a very accomplished actor in Spanish films 50 years later. And she comes, and she really doesn't want anything to do with her father, whether it's her father or not. But they're all assembled in this theater, which has been hiding out in this village and never used, and has huge 35-millimeter projectors that were used for Italians who were shooting Westerns in Spain, we know who those are, used to use this theater to show their dailies.
Oh, wow.
Their 35-millimeter dailies. So they get one of these projectors running, and they all sit there and watch this movie. And it is completely transcendent. And, I mean, every time he, and there are a lot of them throughout the film, close-ups of faces with this kind of chiaroscuro lighting that makes them look like Spanish Renaissance portraits. I mean, they look like Velasquez. It is extraordinary. But this particular scene, which is sustained in that way and cutting between people watching the film and the film itself, it's just one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen.
Yeah. I remember now those scenes at the end, and the close-ups you're talking about. I mean, it sounds silly, but kind of like going back to basics in a way of like the power of the close-up and showing a revelation or understanding or, you know, emotion dawning. Yeah, those are incredible. And that's the same act. It's Anna Torrent. Is that her name?
Yes, it's Anna Torrent.
And Torrent, which is crazy that, to be able to span that his career like that. I don't know what I was expecting. I guess that I didn't even know he was making another movie, because he's one of the absolute classic, like, I'll make it when I make it kind of guys. He's like, you know, I don't know, like one every 10 years or something like that. I also really like the Quince Tree one, right? The painting.
Yeah.
That somehow comes to mind, just, you know, talking about his use of light and how that changes.
And one of the things I'm really curious about is what this movie was shot on.
Mm.
Because, you know, the idea that in digital he could get that last section of shooting those faces sitting in the theater and that they are sublime. I mean, that's something I've not seen anyone do digitally. So I'm very, very curious about what this was shot on. And something about this movie seems to me that it has a subtext about loss of memory and loss of a movie, but it's also loss of celluloid. And certainly there are scenes in here that are about that. But in the end, I'm curious about what he shot it on, and I can't find anything that tells me that.
Seems like that should be somewhere. I mean, you know how Kodak, sometimes they kind of do a list.
Yeah.
So here we go. Cannes 2023 selection features 34 productions shot on Kodak film. That's this year's edition.
Really?
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, there must be including short films.
It must be including short films.
But that's to say, each captured on Kodak 35 millimeter film. And so we have Killers of the Flower Moon, Asteroid City, Fallen Leaves. Yep. Close Your Eyes.
Oh, fantastic.
Actually, it even says it was shot. It says 16 millimeter next to it.
16 millimeter?
Yeah, it says 16.
Wow.
There's been a kind of resurgence. In case anyone's wondering, the Idol was also shit. The TV show. Well, I can't wait to see that one again. And I mean, I guess it bears mentioning, for me, it was also impressive that it's a long film, you know, contains a lot, but I think that in a way only intensifies what happens at the end.
Yeah. I mean, because in the middle, it just seems like, well, this movie is just wandering around.
Yeah.
He goes fishing, and he, you know.
Yeah, it's crazy how that happened. Somehow it has like embedded it in it. I mean, the memory, but the idea of how something is forgotten too, like just that time will kind of pass over it. Other things will go on. That's kind of that feeling I remember having. I don't know. It's funny. I've just been reading. I just sort of picked it up and started reading Buñuel's autobiography, My Last Sigh.
Right.
But the ongoing thing is just like the sense of time stopping in parts of Spain, you know, or just that sensation. So I don't know. I'm kind of thinking of this movie a little bit, what changes and what doesn't over the years, what you can recover and what you can't. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. Why it's called Close Your Eyes?
Frankly, I didn't think about it and I can't explain. I have no.
I guess just generally, it's just like the difference between watching a movie and closing your eyes and like looking through your memory in a way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, now I definitely have to see it, because I have an image in my head of someone closing their eyes in one of those close-ups.
Oh, he does. He absolutely does.
He does? Yeah.
Yes, he does.
So that's Close Your Eyes. And moving on to another attraction, a short film. I forget how they're showing it. I think they were showing it with another one or two things. But the new Godard short, trailer of a film that will never exist, Phony Wars.
Which is kind of thematically like the Close Your Eyes.
Oh, right.
This film that will never exist.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the title is almost, I mean, it's almost not a misnomer, but it makes it sound as if this was something that someone found, you know, or like cobbled together. But it
actually is a Godard film.
Yeah.
Godard was working in, you know, on several projects in the last years of his life. And he was very weak, physically weak. And at a certain point, he knew he couldn't, you know, actually shoot and cut a feature. And this was based on a Spanish novel.
Oh, wow.
Set during the turn toward fascism in Spain, about a bunch of, it's a French novel about a bunch of Trotskyite Communist Party rejects in Spain. But it was going to turn into, clearly it was going to turn into a Godard film that was going to be about anarchists and political people on the left that are rejected by the official parties. And when he decided he couldn't make it, what he seems to have done was, in recent years, you know, if you go to Cannes, all the Godard films, they had press books that were kind of limited editions, and kind of like they were a shooting script, but not really. They had photographs and quotations and collages and sometimes drawings that were relevant and sometimes that you would see in the film, but they were works in themselves. And what you have here is the animation in time of one of these books. So that Godard made one of these books for the film that would have been Phony Wars and gave it with exact timings. This image stays on the screen for 3 seconds, 10 seconds, blah, 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 to his assistant with whom he had been working for many years, Fabrice Aragno. And they made it. I mean, they put it together. The images, the voiceover, the sync sound. There is Godard's voice, very broken and shaky, and something about how Saint Laurent was going to fund this, and a little bit of a kind of woman in fashion model who's going to play one of the anarchists, maybe. And it very much is a Godard film, and in the style of his late films, except, you know, it's the last one. So it's very moving, in part because it is the last one, but it's got a lot in it.
Yeah.
So it and Richard Linklater's Hitman and Green Border and the last 30 minutes of the Ricci film were my favorite films of all.
Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing about the Godard for me was, correct me if I'm remembering wrong, but it's almost all still images or still collages. There's very little like moving video in it, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. The only notable section is that one where the woman who I take to be a Saint Laurent model is running through the street, and then she sits on a rock overlooking the water, looking pensive, while on the soundtrack there's something about Hannah Arendt. And Gershom Scholem saying that Hannah Arendt was like 12 synagogues. I think that's a juxtaposition. But that, as far as I remember, is the only moving image in it. And it's kind of dead center in the middle of this 19 minutes.
No, and I mean, a lot of the rest of it kind of functions like a palimpsest in a way. Pretty dense.
Yeah.
More on the level of, I don't know, Histoires du Cinéma or something more than, but also spare in a way. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack the Phony Wars aspect a bit? I don't know.
Yeah, because what you have, I mean, there are references. Oh, there are other moving images. There are images from some Godard films.
That's right, yeah.
Particularly the films that have to do with Sarajevo. Mm-hmm. What it is a kind of just reference, like you're looking through a table of contents, referencing wars of the 20th century into nearly the present time. So there is a war in Sarajevo, but before that, there's the Spanish Civil War. At a certain point, someone says, no one talks about Algerian immigrants anymore, so the war in Algiers. I mean, all the wars that have preoccupied, and Hannah Arendt, I mean, that's obviously a reference to the Second World War. Why they are phony, I don't know. Maybe their causes are phony and made up so that in Godard's eyes, people who sell munitions can get very rich. I would suspect that's the interpretation.
Yeah.
But it is a kind of compendium of wars from First World War to right now.
Yeah, I want to go back and read what he said about Ukraine. I mean, that must be, like, for everyone, kind of surreal to see that kind of repetition happening.
Yeah.
And that one screened, did they screen it with?
They screened it with two other films.
Oh, yeah, Wong Bing.
Yes.
Was it with the Pedro Costa?
Yes.
Okay.
That was the triple bill. And it's going to actually play at the Film Forum in November with a documentary that someone has made about Godard.
Right.
I don't know anything about that, but it's playing with that.
Right.
And then Kino Lorber is going to put it out in some way.
Yes. That's, yeah. I remember seeing that the kind of the rare acquisition announcement of a short film.
Right.
little different. Yeah, I wonder if that's the same documentary that it was showed with at Cannes, because when I saw it, that it was shown with the short. I think it was a French documentary, which includes footage of the pie in the face incident that happened at Cannes. Oh, well, one last thing is that the actual last work we're going to see?
Well, it seems to be the last work that, in a sense, he wrote and directed.
Mm-hmm.
There are works to come, I think, that have sections in it that he participated in the direction of, or he is on screen in. That's a bit vague. And there was the one that was at the MoMA, which at that point was called the last Godard film, but Godard really didn't make that film.
Hmm.
Godard really made this film, unless, you know, they're exaggerating. He gave the precise timing for every image and sound in the film. So he made it.
Yeah. No, when the movie is this, that's what the directing would entail. It's really interesting because that makes it seem very much like a musical composition in a way.
Yeah.
That then Fabrice Arrigno carried out. They must have worked so closely together in the past, whatever it is, like 10 years, that there must be so many other things. I'm so curious whether Fabrice Arrigno is going to like bring out other things. Like he has the key to the storage, yes, or whatever. Who knows what?
Yes. Yes.
So the Godard short. Maybe we can switch tracks a little and talk about a documentary that's in the festival, a Nikki Giovanni documentary, Going to Mars,
right,
which had its premiere at Sundance. I feel sort of like dropped out of view, or I wasn't, I mean, it won a prize there, but I was glad to see it kind of come back in people's minds. And it'd be great to talk about that here because it's coming right up. I think it's coming out in like 2 or 3 weeks after this publishes.
And where is it going to come out?
I would guess Film Forum. I do know it's like first week of November date.
Uh-huh. And Nikki Giovanni was at the festival, and a lot of people say that the talk she gave live, where she did one of these HBO talks, was the best thing at the festival.
Oh, cool.
I think it's a very, very good documentary. In the end, I just wanted more Nikki. I mean, she's in every shot, but I wanted more because I wanted more Nikki Giovanni.
Yeah.
I mean, she is just an extraordinary poet, activist, teacher, and I was very glad that her political activism as a Black lesbian was so important in the film. But she's just a remarkable person, and of course, she has a gift of words. So to have Nikki Giovanni live on screen talking to basically the audience is amazing. She's also a person who in her life is known for being quite private.
Hmm.
And in the film, you are very aware that there are places she will not go with them. And that's also interesting. I mean, it was interesting to me that documentarians usually cover that over. And they don't like to say, we couldn't get the person to talk about this or that.
That's true.
In this film, you realize that she is willing her story in this film into being, that she has more control over this story than the filmmakers, who are very, very good and very experienced documentary filmmakers. But she has control of this film. And that was so interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's like part documentary, it's like part performance capturing her performance. And I was so struck also just by the different ways she is on film, in front of a crowd and projecting in that way, but also the kind of more interior private moments that there are in the movie.
And it's a part of a general theme we talk about in relation to a movie. I mean, it's about people getting to be old and losing part of their memory. I mean, memory loss is a very, very important part of this film, and part of it that it is that they did great archival work so that you know that there are things that aren't lost.
Yeah. You've seen her read as well, or?
Yeah, I've seen her read. I mean, she's just incredible, incredible reader.
And yeah, and you mentioned the directors. They've done a lot of interesting work in the past as well. Joe Brewster and Michelle Stevenson.
Yeah.
So that is Going to Mars, Nikki Giovanni documentary. And then there was Frederick Wiseman in making
this very long movie set inside a 3-star French restaurant.
Yes.
And, you know, all of Wiseman's movies in one way or another are about how something gets done. They are basically process movies set within institutions, whether they are, you know, theater companies, which is what he seems to be preoccupied with lately, the Paris Opera Ballet, and as opposed to the early documentaries, which are like, you know, set in various institutions that are not very good, like high schools and mental asylums and things like that. But this film is really amazing, and obviously it's going to be an enormous hit, except for the fact that it's 4 hours long. I mean, I'm not sure that won't work against it. And I was engrossed for all 4 hours. It's inside this French restaurant, a 3-star Michelin restaurant that's been run by a family for many years. And it's basically how it's done.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about it. And it is extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. It's long, but there's a kind of relaxed aspect to it. I mean, I have to think that some part of him's like, I like this food. I think I'm going to make something about what I like, you know?
Exactly.
Which I think kind of comes through because, I mean, my understanding is that he spends a lot of his time in France, and maybe, I think he was almost like marooned there during the pandemic for a while.
He basically lives in France. Yeah, and he said this documentary took him 9 weeks to shoot. So basically, he was in this restaurant backstage or at tables for 9 weeks.
Yeah.
And I asked him if they enjoyed doing it. And he said, oh, they enjoyed it a lot. So that kind of pleasure is just really out there in front of the movie. And it's rare.
Yeah.
You know, and it sustains. But it's mostly the how-to, because now people are so engrossed since the pandemic and people started cooking. They had nothing else to do at home except watch Netflix and cook.
Yeah.
I was in McNally Jackson Bookstore, which is now moved around the corner from me on Prince Street. You know, it's a really crowded bookstore. You can barely navigate the aisles. The largest section seems to be the cooking section. You know, it has 3 full walls and 2 tables, floor-to-ceiling walls of cooking books, of cookbooks, and cooking memoirs. It is literally the largest section of books. It's larger than art, larger than American history. It's larger, I think maybe novels are still larger, but this is rivals novels. So I think this movie, which will be at Film Forum at the end of November, will be a big success.
Yeah, I think so. Even though in a way it doesn't always look like other movies or TV shows or online clips about cooking in the sense...
Oh, nothing like that.
Yeah. I mean, if he shows someone cooking, I mean, most of the frame is going to be like the person cooking, the person talking to the person cooking, and like the head chef watching the whole thing, because he's still interested in how it works on like an interpersonal like process level, maybe less so about the sizzling or the spices or whatever. I just kind of imagine him just grinning, watching the exchanges with people eating, because there's almost like this whole game of like cultural telephone going on where details and ideas about the food are being passed along and then kind of reshaped according to how they think the person is taking it or what they want to hear in a way. It's also interesting just like navigating between like presenting the food, but also being super polite. And I don't know, I loved watching that because I think like transmission is like something that has been important to him. You mentioned like more recently he's been in theater or in stage stuff, but like something like National Gallery, thinking about preservation and the talk around a piece of culture, a piece of art.
Right.
One thing I was sort of thinking while watching is how much he thinks of the food as an artistic endeavor or as a cultural endeavor or what. I don't know how you felt about that. Or if it matters even. I don't know if it does. But
I don't know that it matters. It certainly, I'm sure he thinks of it as a cultural endeavor, whether it is art. And it's also an endeavor that involves the exchange of considerable amounts of money.
Yes.
And, you know, they are quite frugal in their method. I mean, one part of their kitchen is how they manage to use everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little that goes to waste, but food in that restaurant costs a great deal.
Yeah.
You know, people are coming in and they're spending oodles of money.
And they're staying there. That's something I didn't realize.
You mean they stay over?
Yeah, yeah. Because like attached to it are these rooms, that they... So it's like, it's a full commitment, mm-hmm. Which I guess maybe in a way is also kind of old fashioned if it's like an inn where you're also eating.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, kind of think people will be into it because I think people who watch these things, they watch that amount of that stuff. So it's like, they want the four bookshelves of cookbook or three bookshelves of cookbook. So.
Right. I mean, 4 hours aren't exactly like coming there and spending the weekend.
That's true.
But you don't get to eat anything either.
You don't. No, I was expecting that they would have some like tie-in. I mean, with some restaurant or something. So that is a Menu Plaisir Les Trois Gros. I have to admire him for choosing a title that's such a like impenetrable mouthful. It's just like Trois Gros. I mean, that's the family name. That's what that is. Well, maybe we can finish up with a movie I'm curious, you mentioned, ties into a kind of larger theory that you're working on. May-December, the new Todd Haynes film. So what did you think of May-December?
I think it's a difficult film. I mean, I think on the one hand, the filmmaking and the actors, actually the three leading actors, two of whom we know very well, Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore. Julianne Moore we know from other Todd Haynes films. This is the first time he's worked with Natalie Portman. But it's really a kind of triangle film. So there is a younger actor who I'd never seen before, who emerges as really the central character in the movie. You have these two women around this guy. And it is a Todd Haynes film in that it is impeccably made, multi-referential in terms particularly of melodrama and women's films, and overwhelmingly referential in that he uses the score from Joseph Losey's The Go-Between, and he blankets the entire movie with that score. A little bit changed because he did have a composer who arranged it, but I really couldn't tell the arrangement from the original. So that is, in terms of formality, a really interesting thing, because if you've ever heard that score, you will wake up singing it every single morning. I mean, it's been 3 weeks since I've seen this movie, and I still wake up with it in my head every single morning. It's a very percussive book. Piano embedded in an orchestral score. And once you've heard it, you will never forget it.
Yeah.
And it is set in an island off the coast of Georgia, near Savannah. And it's based on an actual case history that was, you know, given full tabloid treatment at the end of the 80s about a woman in her 30s, married with a child, maybe two, who works in a pet store and has an affair with a 13-year-old Korean-American boy. 13. Just reaches puberty. And she is eventually arrested and goes to jail, where she has the child that she's conceived with him in jail, and she's released, and they get married. And they have two more children, and she refuses to leave the town where she had spent most of her life and seems absolutely to have built up a wall to the fact that she's done something really quite horrible and to the fact that people in the town still send her packages of shit on her birthday. And eventually in the film, Natalie Portman is playing an actor who is going to play this woman in a TV movie about her and wants a more accurate presentation than what was in the tabloids. And so descends on this family to find out the truth so she can perform. So it is about two monstrous women, two monstrously self-involved, narcissistic women. The Julianne Moore character, who has absolutely no idea how badly she fucked up this guy's life and is continuing to infantilize him. And a Natalie Portman character who just wants to get it right and seems totally unaware about how absolutely invasive her presence is. In other words, Todd Haynes has always made films about women who, in certain cases, like the Julianne's character in Safe, was really a victim of patriarchy.
Hmm.
And Julianne's character in Far From Heaven is oppressed, but by the end, you have the feeling that she's going to emerge as a heroine. I always think at the end of Far From Heaven, when she drives off, she's going all the way to Boston to found the first women's bookstore. And so these characters are, I don't know how other people feel about them, but I dislike them intensely.
Hmm.
And that's curious. And I think the movie is a reaction in part to the heroicizing or the whitewashing of women characters in movies these days, although that's not absolutely across the board true, but there's an awful lot of it. And these women are in no way role models or heroines. I was kind of amazed reading stuff out of Cannes. I saw it here, I didn't see it there, where so many people reacted to the movie as if it was camp.
Mm.
There's not a camp moment in this movie. Unless it's the very last scene where you see a scene as it's being shot from the movie that Natalie Portman is in. And I don't know, she's playing with like the snake in the Garden of Eden.
Oh, right.
And that's kind of camped. But aside from that, this is deadly serious and really nasty.
No, I know what you're talking about. And I mean, honestly, hearing you describe it, I feel kind of weird about how successfully I get taken away by the kind of spectacle on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
for each character, which I guess is part of what he's doing, which is that, I mean, you forget about the origin point because the movie is already one level removed because it's about the next story that will be told about this first story.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really interesting thing. And in a way, I mean, I hadn't thought of it before, but that I don't think this is like a primary thing the movie's doing, but it does make me think about how that's a situation we're perpetually in, where we're like, something is happening, like some awful thing maybe, but we're talking about the story around it.
Yep.
or about how it's playing and the images that are made out of it. And you lose sight of the original, the facts themselves or the original people involved or anything like that.
I mean, the other thing is the guy who, till Natalie Portman shows up, seems to be oddly content with his total infantilization. I mean, he has kids who are now in college, and the crisis in this family is that the younger two kids are going off to college this year, and they're going to have to face being alone with each other, and that what is this marriage about? But then Natalie Portman shows up, and it becomes this triangle. And in that, the guy emerges, actually giving some thought to what he's been doing with his life. I mean, you know, why did he stay with this woman who, you know, it's statutory rape.
Right. The way he gets to that point of self-awareness is by, in a way, being taken advantage of again.
Yes, exactly.
The character, he's sensitive. He's a sensitive kid. I think it's, I mean, you see him with his children and like he's, mm-hmm. I mean, the actor is Charles Melton. I mean, he's good at shifting through all these different levels, and with his own children, he's so warm to the point that it's sort of, they make have a little comedy around that, you know, I love the scene where he gets high for the first time. So mm-hmm. he becomes the kid again. Yeah. But he gets to a point where he becomes some sort of self-aware.
And that these two women are really more interested in each other than they are in him. I mean, Natalie Portman does, you know, seduce all over again this guy, but her focus, when it's ever off herself, is really on the Julianne Moore character. It's not really on him. He's like a kind of pawn in her game.
Hmm.
And he understands that, and he's able to find some... his way out of this puzzle because they're so busy mirroring each other.
Yeah, this kind of aggressive mirroring and repulsion going on. Oh, and one other thing, just with the casting, I mean, I had kind of forgotten about how strange in a way it felt having these two actresses together in a movie. And I don't really know why or put a finger on it, but I remember like hearing about the casting and then seeing them, and especially he kind of makes the most of it. He'll have scenes where they're both in frame, and not that they haven't both done, you know, ensemble work, but there's a real like spark or tension at having them, like people who are like the center, the star attention together in that way. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, this was Natalie Portman's project.
Uh-huh.
Natalie Portman came to Todd with this script that was already written. It was changed a little bit, but not very much, and asked him if he was interested in directing it. And he read it, and he was, and he always wanted to work with her, he said. And then he saw that there was an ideal part for Julianne Moore, so what could have been better? But it was Natalie Portman's project.
Yeah, that was actually something that in the screening, the public screening, I guess an opening night, Todd Haynes is describing a little bit. I mean, it sounded like he made it sound like he slipped the script. It sounded like without like talking with Natalie Portman about it to Julianne Moore, and then just kind of let it run from there. Mm-hmm. Just kind of fun. Do you want to talk about a bit more about that idea?
Well, there are a couple of films in this festival. I actually thought of three, this being one of them. The second is Annie Baker's film, Janet Planet. And it seems to me that both Janet Planet and Todd Haynes' film are about bad mothers, narcissistic mothers. As Todd puts it, mothers who are, or he didn't use the word mothers, but people who are absolutely unaware of who they are and never take responsibility for the effect of their total phoniness on other people. So that Julianne Moore, who is narcissistic enough to seduce a 14-year-old boy and then marry him, keep him for years and years in this relationship, and the mom in Janet Planet, who is monstrous in her absolute unawareness of what she is doing to her daughter and the kind of totally phony belief she has in her own desirability and what the meaning of other people are in her life. And I think that in these films, it is that people who know they have a reputation for being liberal or feminists now feel free to say, well, yeah, but all women don't live their lives in a very good manner. And many of them are totally, and their crime, because it's the same crime in both movies, is their absolute refusal to look at themselves and be self-aware. Even though in Annie Planet, the woman, that's what she's trying to do all the time. I mean, they're, in a way, they handle the problem. Julianne Moore just refuses any kind, that character refuses any kind of introspection or self-analysis in any way. And that's why her mirroring with Natalie Portman is so strong, because they're two women who don't know who they are turning the mirrors on each other. That's really complicated. Tana Planet isn't complicated at all. You just have an unfortunate mother who's probably treated this little girl in a way that she clearly will survive, but must have been extremely painful for her. And the young actor who plays Tana Planet's daughter is really, really good. I mean, she's a really, really wonderful actor, and she's been directed very well.
Yeah. I agree.
But I think the rest of the film is basically a two-page New Yorker memoir. And that's it. Blown up into slow cinema.
It sounds like I liked it more. Well, what did you think of the decision that Janet makes? At the beginning of the movie, she has this kind of slob of a boyfriend, and there's this dramatic scene where he has like a migraine or...
Yeah.
And then he like slams the door on the child, on her daughter, and she seems to have a moment of like self-awareness there about what she was allowing in the home, or I don't know.
All these guys are creepy.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all creeps.
Yeah.
They're all self-important creeps.
Yeah.
And that she gets rid of them fairly quickly, they kind of seem to rotate, because one of them, I think, comes back.
That's right, yeah.
Means that at a certain point, her lying about who they are blows up in her face. But she never stopped lying about the fact that, that line about, I knew you'd be a lesbian because I'm the kind of woman, to her daughter. I kind of figured you'd be a lesbian because men wouldn't put up with you. Whereas I'm the kind of woman who can make any man fall instantly in love with me. Well, if the men are as creepy as you are, that's true. What can I say?
Yeah, that is an incredible exchange there. I remember that. I just remembered the other movie that you were talking about last summer.
Oh, right. Yeah, and that's a woman who does do something terrible, but is incredibly self-aware. I mean, this is a kind of different basis. This is a really intelligent lawyer who is married to a kind of boring guy who's somewhat older than she is, and his gorgeous fucked up son comes to live with them and, you know, throws himself on this woman, on the mother, and she gives in and has sex. I mean, it's against her better judgment, but she fuck all knows what she's doing. She knows it isn't a good thing. And in the end, she lies and betrays him to save herself and her marriage. She is not a good person, and she probably has harmed this boy. But this is about, you know, sometimes sex is, you just don't handle it the right way. And she knows that. The difference between these two other movies is that those two women don't know, will not admit that they've done anything really bad, will not admit that to themselves. She does, and then she lies to save her career and her marriage. I mean, maybe you could say it's French. It's more French.
Right, yeah. No, yeah, I mean, Julianne Moore's, what is the line? She's like, I've always been naive. It's been like a gift or something like that.
Exactly.
For her, it's been a gift.
Yeah.
With the Breillat film, it's like, that feels like something that she's or has done before.
Yeah. And that sex is a very powerful thing. And it often makes you do things that you might regret because they're harmful in some way or another. But it's very difficult to do the right thing in certain situations. That's very different. And what I liked about the first maybe three quarters of an hour of this film is she has such, one, is that the woman is so smart. You very seldom see women who are that smart. And she's a lawyer. And she's just an interesting character in that way. And that she's a lawyer who basically is involved with helping young girls who are in trouble because they've been branded sluts or they've been raped or whatever. But her awareness of bodies and how just close or far away you block an actor in a scene so that it is absolutely, there are two scenes in which her breasts, which are not in any way notable, but simply the fact that their breasts are like inescapable for the other person on the screen. In one case, it's her husband. In one case, it's the boy. She is so good at that, Rhea. I could watch her films forever for just that reason.
And the way she films it in terms of the shot length, too, there is such a charge to which the duration, I mean, of not cutting away in the sex scenes, you know. That's also something that's always been kind of incredible in her films, especially in one of them holding on Leo Drucker. Like, she just seems like in her own world, you know. It's like it's almost what becomes like incidental what she's done, you know. And yeah, she, Leo Drucker, I just thought was absolutely amazing. I mean, this is like one of my favorite performances this year. Haven't seen Brea movie in a while. Now I feel like she's had a lot of influence, but since she hadn't made something in a while, people were forgetting what she's capable of. So that was last summer. And I feel like I would be leaving something out if we didn't have room for you to say something about a movie that a lot of people like, but I know that you do not. And that is Poor Things.
Oh. I mean, you know, a lot of people said to me, you're finally going to like one of his movies, because I don't like his movies. I think they're profoundly ugly. Mm-hmm. I hate the shy lenses. I mean, they are just like meaningless. And I mean, his actors love him and he indulges them and they just have themselves all over the screen. I don't like his movies, but everyone said, this one is a feminist movie. You're going to really love it. Well, it is as far from a feminist movie as anything I could think of. It kind of takes place in a kind of Victorian England, Europe, that kind of looks like illustrations for H.G. Wells. And his favorite actor, Emma Stone. It's a kind of Frankenstein story. I mean, it is a Frankenstein story. So Willem Dafoe plays a kind of character who's already looks like Frankenstein's monster because his father was monstrous. And they're a lineage of doctors or surgeons or some such that do obscure operations.
Right.
And so the Emma Stone character has tried to kill herself. She, in a beautiful blue dress, plummets off a bridge over something like a Venice canal or I don't know what. And he finds her corpse and she was pregnant. And so he takes the brain of the fetus and implants it in the body of the mother, and with all kinds of Frankenstein-like electricity, we get a person who has physicality of a 20-year-old, but the brain of an infant who in the film then goes through a development process until her brain matures to be what her body is. And at first it's incredibly tedious to see Emma Stone toddling around her, you know, 5'10" body as if she had no control of her feet and her limbs. And that's really tedious, and a lot is made of that. And her throwing her food and acting like a child with the terrible twos, that's really tedious. But then she begins to graduate into a kind of provocative Lolita character, and then on and on into an adolescent, insatiable, what used to be called a nymphomaniac, who just is totally innocent about sex, and he calls it furious jumping. And of course, is the fantasy of any guy who would meet her, because it's sex without any kind of attachment or responsibility or anything. And then she becomes a compliant prostitute when she gets hooked up with Mark Ruffalo, and by her generosity loses all their money, and so she becomes a prostitute to save them, but he's turned off by this, so she's just a prostitute because she likes it. And she makes a lot of money. And then she gets free of this bordello, and she eventually makes her way back to the Dr. Frankenstein who made her, but then realizes that she's lured in by a very rich guy who has bought her or wants her. And then she offs him, and she's free. I mean, what the fuck? And Emma Stone, who I guess will do anything, kind of, except have any real feeling on the screen whatsoever for even a single instant, and that was La La Land as well. Mm-hmm. I do not think Emma Stone is a good actor. I think Emma Stone will do anything, and is basically having herself up there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think. And she is the show. If you don't really want to watch Emma Stone, there is no movie.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, it would wear thin very quickly. So you're saying that it's kind of like a regressive fantasy that people are taking as if it's like a liberation narrative.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. In other words, she's not going to grow up to be Leah Drucker, ever.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope it's not a symptom of my fantasy that I didn't see it as a fantasy, but it gives me food for thought to think of it as that for sure. What do we talk about? Production values?
I mean, you know, it's got a lot of effects.
Yeah.
A lot of students who I teach who don't really care about anything except effects. So, you know, it's like the art version of a Marvel movie. I don't
She's a sexual superhero or something like that.
Exactly.
Which people argue that that's one of the biggest problems about the superheroes taking over monopoly on screens is that they are asexuals. But
right.
Well, that's Poor Things, and that's coming out this fall. I mean, I'm still surprised that I like it, but I'm still surprised that people like it as much as they do because I found it like pretty weird. I mean, it's, some of it might be like a bit mannered weird, but fundamentally like pretty strange spectacle. I mean, did you feel like it was strange or just did it feel just kind of gimmicky?
It felt like an actor studio class where they tell you to do exactly what Emma Stone did through this movie. Now imagine yourself as a 2-year-old, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Imagine yourself as a monkey. Whatever.
Now go. So yeah, we can finish there. We'll go off and see more movies.
What we didn't talk about is coming up now is The Sweet East, which I think you've covered, but it's coming up in the festival, and I think that's quite good.
Oh yeah, that you like that one a lot.
I like it well enough.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it would be on the list of I'm glad I saw it. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of picaresque look at America with a very naive young woman who learns as she moves from enclave to enclave of kind of young people, for the most part, on the extreme left and the extreme right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gorgeous. It's great. It's one of the great movies about America where America looks fantastic. And that, of course, the director is also very, very, John Price Williams is a really wonderful DP. So that movie and La Chimera, the Italian film in the festival, I thought were the most beautiful films that I saw. But in an odd way, it's like a reverse version of Robert Kramer's Milestone, which is a film that I don't like at all. Where a person who hasn't lived in America in a long time but refuses to admit it comes back and takes a tour of what's going on, mostly in the American left.
Hmm.
And by the time Kramer came back, he had no understanding whatsoever of what's going on in the American left. And so it pontificates in a very odd way. This movie does the opposite of pontificating, because the central character really doesn't know anything in advance. And yet you are not against her because she's so naive. You are kind of having these experiences with her. And I found it not a great movie, but just so surprising in its scenes and what it looked at and how it looked that I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting just having talked about Poor Things to talk about this, because I guess in this case, she's at every turn is kind of faced with men who end up wanting to take advantage of her in some way.
Right.
And I want to just actress's name, because she is in Never, Rarely, Sometimes.
Rarely, Sometimes, Always, and she plays the cousin of the main character.
Talia Ryder, Sweet East, coming soon to the festival. And I think they just announced that it's also getting a theatrical release December, I want to say. All right. Well, we'll leave it there and we'll have more to talk about later in the fall, I'm sure.
Have a good day, Nick.
Have a good day, too.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.